good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, March 24th, 2022. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody. And
hello.
Happy Cheesesteak Day.
I love cheesesteaks.
I had one the other night with my son at a basketball game, and it was tasty. Not necessarily good for my liver, mind you, but tasty nevertheless. But listen, more importantly, it's also National Cocktail Day. So, yeah, I think about celebrating this day with your favorite cocktail or two if you happen to occasionally imbibe. In fact, have it with a good old Philly cheesesteak while you're at it.
Yeah, I would choose a cheesesteak. I remember Pat's Steaks. You know them? Do you know Pat's Steaks?
Indeed. Dave? Indeed, I
do. So anyone around Philadelphia would know Pat's Steaks. It always used to be interesting. I mean, this goes back when I lived in Philadelphia for 1 year, back in 1975 and 76. And it was amazing because if you went out for the evening and you decided to, you know how you kind of get hungry, and we would go to Pat's Steaks, and it was just a cheesesteak shop that didn't have seating, if I recall.
Yeah, you just have a service window.
Yeah, it's probably one of the first fast food servers. And you would see people of all makes and kinds. You'd see people in evening gowns all decked out. You'd see people in jeans sitting on the curb, eating Pat's Steaks. Yes. I mean, that was a place to go after an evening out. It didn't matter what you were doing.
Last time my wife and I were there with a bunch of friends coming home after a concert, there was a wedding party just getting out of the limousine. This was probably 12:30, 1 in the morning.
Yeah. Yep. So it was always kind of interesting. You'd see, you know, no matter what your occasion was, from, you know, just going to hang out in the jeans to formal wear, you'd see them, you know, at 12, 1 o'clock in the morning eating Pat's Steaks on the curb. Anyway, so down memory lane, here we go. Gold had a little bit of memory today to the upside, up $17.40 at $1,962. Silver was up 40 cents at $25.62. Platinum was up 3 at $1,030. Palladium was up $2 at $2,600. USDX today was up 15. 98.77. Crude oil was down 377 at 111. It's WTI. Paper markets today, they rebounded. You had the Dow rally 300 points, 34,707. S&P up 63, 4,520. NASDAQ up 269, 14,191. I guess it's the rallying cry of the New World Order out there. So the Nikkei, Shanghai and the Hang Seng were negative. Nikkei was positive. Europe was mixed. FTSE was the only one that was really stronger of the three that we usually talk about. 10-year yield is moving 2.35%. 2.35%. And even Brent crude was down 3% at 117. Natural gas, though, was higher. Up 3% for natural gas, but the oils were down. So, chip stocks led the market. And, so I don't know, Dave, there's, I feel a sneeze coming on, Dave. So, but, I guess there's more. Well, we'll follow up on the sanctions here. We're now entering the second month of the Russian-Ukraine situation. And there's been attempts with the U.S. top defense and military leaders to speak with their Russian counterparts, but they've been rejected. So you have the two world's largest nuclear powers in the dark about explanations for the military movements. And, of course, this always brings the fears of a major miscalculation. So a lot of things are going on today with Biden being over there and meeting with the NATO and, of course, the G7 too, Dave, today. I figured that's why the markets are higher.
Well, yeah, who knows? But
yeah, who knows why?
We're also learning that a so-called tiger team at the White House, a group of national security officials, is talking about sketching out responses for the U.S. and its allies if Putin unleashes stockpiles of chemical, biological, or, God forbid, nuclear weapons. Meeting three times a week in classified sessions, this team is also looking at responses if Russia seeks to extend the war to neighboring countries like Moldova, Georgia, even Poland, and how to prepare European countries for the refugees flowing on a scale that certainly hasn't been seen in several decades. Yesterday,
except at our border.
What's that?
Except at our border.
Oh, hey. Senate Armed Services Chair Jack Reed said at an event that biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons use in Ukraine would trigger a response from NATO if fallout from the attack drifted into a neighboring member. It reminds me of something that Dr. Helen Caldicott said back in the 70s, that a nuclear accident anywhere in the world is a nuclear accident everywhere in the world. And Reed added that it would be perceived as an attack against NATO. Very unsettling time, Melody. Almost makes you long for a Black Hawk Down like incident of the 1990s.
Hmm. Well, you know, it is. I mean, I don't know why he would go into any other nation at this point in time, because country at this point in time, because, you know, he has his focus on Ukraine. And but I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's just weird.
Well, it makes you wonder if, you know, some of these military types.
That's what I'm afraid of.
God bless Volodymyr Zelensky. But it makes you wonder if some of these military, part of the military industrial complex is, you know, starting its contingency planning, you know, involving some of the firms that made tens, if not hundreds of millions in profits in Iraq and Afghanistan. And just looking for an excuse to get them back involved again.
You never know who really truly fires the first shot, do you?
Yeah, real. That's right.
I mean, you really don't know, and you're right. There's tons of money to be made, and you just never know what could possibly strike the match in order to push this another step further. And I think that's, you know, it's not, you know, it's these generals and everything that concern me, because that's what they train for. They train for war, right, Dave? I mean, that's what they do. And it's, I don't know. There's a lot to be concerned about. Even though the U.S. is planning to put more sanctions on more Russian individuals and entities, including over 300 lawmakers from the Duma, the lower house of the Russian parliament, more Russian elites. The EU and G7 will also inform international organizations that at this point forward, they are no longer to operate with Russia under business as usual standards. I don't think they have been, but their purpose is to methodically remove the benefits and privileges Russia once enjoyed as a participant in the international economic order. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. You know, this is the second question they have to ask, you know. The international economic order, you know, it's just, I don't know.
It's like a new dawn every other day these days. I mean, the U.S. apparently preparing to provide more than $1 billion in new funding for humanitarian assistance. Talking about improving food security in Ukraine. across Ukraine, which has been thrown into chaos. As we've mentioned in the past on this program, both Russia and Ukraine are among the top five. Russia's the number one, and I think Ukraine number five exporters of grain. Apparently, through our government's Feed the Future initiative, U.S. will provide $11 billion over the next 5 years to address food security issues there. Another $320 million in new funding to advance democratic principles in that part of the world.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that grand? Isn't that grand? I'm not spending some of that money here. But, you know, why would we spend $320 million in funding? You know, we're just, anyway, U.S. is working again to freeze Russia's gold reserves. It's one of the newest sanctions. They have nearly $132 billion in gold reserves. But that's in the Chinese yuan, so I don't know how anybody can control that. Janet Yellen is going to talk to some bipartisan group of senators and to discuss the move. I don't know what they can do if it's, you know, if it's in the yuan, in Chinese currency. I don't think there's much they can do. Now, they can talk about it, but I don't think there's much they can do. Dave, do you think?
I don't know. I honestly don't know.
It's not like it's sitting there in dollars. He can still move, so they would have to put pressure on China. That ain't gonna happen. So, you know, and then what are they going what were they trying to do with it?
I mean, Russia.
Now, what are they trying to do with his gold? Make him sell it, or you know,
I think just
steal it from him.
Preventing him from using it, from cashing it in to fund the war effort. Mm-hmm. I think that's the primary goal. Again, if it's in the yuan, it certainly complicates matters, particularly without China's intervention.
And they have quite a bit of it.
Now, it could be that, I mean, to the extent that anything needs to be, I mean, short of direct aid from another country, presumably everything would have to be converted to rubles. And, you know, there the U.S. And the West does have some measured control. But again, it's a very complicated, convoluted process. That I think is going to make this particular aspect a problem. Challenge.
Well, they better better not prevent him from cashing in his gold because he's got those debt payments coming up. So if they prevent him from cashing in his gold, I'm sure what I would do is, hey, I'll just pay those debt in rubles. So I think, again, he has more leverage as that goes. Than what we would do if we started messing with his gold, then he couldn't sell it. Wouldn't you think?
Well, I don't know. The value of the ruble is down so much.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends how much he's got floating within the country, and that's accessible by his agents to fund the war. And I think by the sounds of things, I mean, with apparently, a number of Russian soldiers not even having decent footwear. Soldiers are dropping out because of frostbite and what have you. It sounds like they've got a reinvestment issue that's going to cost money and take some time. So. That's what worries me about, you know, with their arsenal of missiles and cachet of other types of weapons that, you know, the longer this goes on, the more you got to start to fear that Putin's going to use some of them.
Let's see. Let's go ahead and go to the jobless claims. It's jobless claims Thursday. In economic news, new applications for jobless benefits dropped to a 52-year low last week. At the same time, the number of Americans on unemployment rolls continued to shrink. We're continuing to see the diminishing labor market slack that will keep wage inflation rising. Initial claims for the state unemployment benefits fell 28,000 to a seasonally adjusted 187,000 for the week ended March 19th. And it just kind of reminds me, as we were going through the Trump through almost every administration, how they get these numbers. And it's like, oh, it's the lowest level since September of 1969. Oh, it's the lowest level. And it just cracks me up. And it's like, you can't even compare the two. And neither one is relative to what's really going on. And they did it through, they do it all the time. Let's see. Economists had forecast 212,000 applications for the latest weeks. We have claims have declined from a record high of 6.1 million in early April of 2020. And again, Dave, 6.1 million, those aren't new jobs. Those are just jobs that came back from the pandemic.
Right.
You know, there was no creation of these jobs. Lockdowns were eliminated, so there was jobs available, but they were not created. It's not like you're in a good economy and you continue creating. Anyway, we still have companies that are literally desperate for workers. There were 11.3 million job openings at the end of January, and that with a record of 1.8 open positions per unemployed person. This misalignment between demand for labor and supply is boosting wage growth. Some will say that is providing some cushion to households against the rising gasoline prices and food, but no way it helps them out, but no way are they conquering the impact of inflation.
Well, the joke of it is that, you know, they're still talking about the headline unemployment rate falling to a 2-year low of 3.8% in February. I mean,
I know.
You include just the short-term discouraged workers and those working part-time and want a full-time job. It's double that at 7.6%. That's the number we ought to be talking about, but that nobody is.
Nobody does. And we also have to be talking about our break because I hear the music and it seems like we're going into one. So we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk TimUpRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody in the office, the rest of the program. Give her a call at 1-800-375-4188. Here's something that'll get your crawl. It certainly has gotten ours. Companies in the S&P 500 bought a record amount of their own stock last year and don't show any signs of slowing down. Flush with cash from good earnings, companies repurchased a massive $882 billion of stocks last year. Too big to fail, Goldman Sachs is forecasting stock buybacks to breach the $1 trillion mark this year, even as companies grapple with rising inflation, higher interest rates, and, well, the potential for stunted economic growth. Companies use these repurchases in large part to return cash to investors and arbitrarily prop up their stock's price. Earnings per share, that EPS number, thus increased because there are fewer shares outstanding. Now, buybacks also, to a lesser extent, signal confidence from leadership about a company's financial prospects, although skeptics say it's more about companies trying to artificially create a public perception of those prospects. Whatever the case, during the fourth quarter, one out of seven companies in the S&P 500 increased their EPS by at least 4% thanks to their lowered share count from the buybacks. Companies like Amazon and GE have approved additional repurchases, setting the stage for that trillion-dollar bonanza in 2022. As we know, stocks fell as much as 12% to start this year before the recent rally. Some analysts say indications are the companies continued to buy back shares through the downturn, which means they'll be getting more shares for their expenditures and reducing share count even further, resulting in even higher earnings per share. In other words, those higher earnings per share are making some stocks look better than, well, perhaps they are. Goldman Sachs expects buybacks to continue representing the largest use of cash for S&P 500 companies. Next in line are capital expenses. Companies are plowing more of their cash into repurchasing their own stock, even as they face higher expenses for raw materials, shipping, and labor. So far, companies have largely been able to pass those costs on to their customers. That's the key point. But higher prices on everything from food to clothing could eventually threaten consumer spending. I mean, they're already certainly affecting consumer sentiment, and a significant pullback by consumers could certainly crimp sales growth for many companies. What's unclear is the eventual impact of interest rate increases by the Fed and other central banks around the world. And any unexpected hit to the global economies could put companies, multinationals, particularly, in a tighter financial position than they anticipated. We know when the pandemic delivered an unexpected hit to the global economies in 2020, many companies encountered steep drops in sales and profits and higher outlays of cash. Many were criticized on having spent lavishly on buybacks the year before instead of building a cash cushion for the downturn. For now, though, companies are plowing ahead with buybacks. Amazon, by the way, which was one of the biggest beneficiaries from the pandemic accelerated shift to online shopping, announced a $10 billion stock buyback plan earlier this month. GE's plan is to repurchase up to $3 billion in shares. Now, if you think that has your code, check out this one. Wall Street bonuses reached a record average of $257,500 last year in New York, according to Axios. Including bonuses, the average salary in the city's financial securities industry grew by almost 8%. Well, that was in 2020, to $438,000, which is about five times higher than the average salary for the rest of the private sector there, $92,300. And the number of people employed in the industry last year at 180,000 was still 10% smaller than its peak in 2000. Now, while New York City and New York State continue to be the center of American securities, the region's total share of jobs has declined to 18% last year from 33% in 1990. It's a big turnaround. Too big to fail banks and employers across all industries have been boosting salary and benefits the last year or so. With bonus season underway in Wall Street, 10 million to 25 million payouts are some of the largest in a decade. The biggest investment banks, too big to fail, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Citigroup shelled out an astounding $18 billion more last year in compensation than in 2020. Goldman Sachs specifically spent roughly $500 million in special stock bonuses for 400 of its top-ranking executives. While the bonus, what's that, an average of $1,250,000 roughly per? While the bonus pool for investment bankers at J.P. Morgan was about 33% higher than in 2020. Now, big tech has been catching up, too. It's not just the financial securities industry. Apple, for example, is reportedly offering $180,000 in stock to keep its top employees. Well, as we had mentioned before in this program, Amazon has increased its max base pay to $350,000. Overall, IT and business services like consulting, staffing, marketing, and research reported cash bonuses growing 17 to 18%. Elsewhere, 17% of employers across nearly two dozen sectors reported 2021 holiday bonuses would rise from the prior year, compared to just 7 and 9% of employers in 2020 and 2019, respectively. The size of these pay stubs also speak to the way economic inequality has grown over the past 2 years. Now, if you're thinking, when will this employer generosity wane? I'd keep on thinking. In other words, not any time soon. Now, when it comes to gold prices, talked about and written about stagflation, and stagflation fears outweigh the expectations of a more aggressive Federal Reserve. Stagflation is when it's essentially higher inflation and lower growth at the same time. Well, anyway, Singapore's United Overseas Bank, UOB for short, their latest outlook on gold, anyway, also comes with new price projections for the coming year. It says that the key drivers for gold will continue to be inflation fears, slower economic growth, and increasing demand for safe haven. Just about what we're seeing right now. We'll need another month to see how first quarter growth slowed down from last year. Now, 2 weeks ago, gold made a run for record highs, testing the 2070 level. The move came after the U.S. announced additional sanctions against Russia, including that oil import ban. The bank also noted that investors are also more inclined to allocate more towards gold in times like these. And that increased demand right now has been in the form of both ETFs, i.e. paper, and physical gold, i.e. Coins, the good old bullion. Bank believes purchases of gold jewelry from individual investors will also likely intensify alongside global central bank diversification of their reserves into gold. There will also be more demand from central banks, the report added. Various central banks, particularly in the emerging market space, they say, will continue to diversify their reserve holdings into gold, meaning more purchases, meaning other things being equal, higher prices. The bank's upward updated price forecast sees gold trading by at $2,100 an ounce in the second quarter, $2,150 an ounce in the third, and $2,200 towards the end of the year. The bank noted the ongoing rise in energy and commodity prices will be keenly felt in economies across the world in the months ahead as inflation rises further and growth slows down concurrently, and safe haven inflows to gold take over as a key dominant driver. Again, don't wait for prices to go up too high. Get in while you can. Call us at 1-800 375-4188. Now, speaking of inflation, it's raging. And with state coffers flush with cash, listen to this. We've talked about it a little bit in terms of gas. A couple weeks ago, more governors and lawmakers across the U.S. are talking about using the federal government model to help ease the pain their people are feeling at the gas pump and grocery store by sending them more money. At least a dozen states now propose giving rebate checks of several hundred dollars directly to taxpayers. California, Kansas, Minnesota. There are critics, skeptics, who say those checks won't go far enough given the pace of inflation and are pushing instead for permanent tax cuts. Now, there's a proposal from Maine Governor Janet Mills. It's among the most generous in the state, where the cost of food and fuel has skyrocketed recently. The Democratic governor there wants to send $850 to most residents as part of the state's budget bill. In addition to the direct rebates, lawmakers and governors are considering sales tax cuts, property tax relief, and suspending or reducing state gas taxes. These proposals come at a time when many states actually have too much money on their hands, largely because of federal pandemic aid and, well, booming tax revenues. It's also happening as the war in Ukraine has compounded soaring prices for fuel and other essential goods and services. So it's no coincidence that the relief is being floated. It's an election year, too, let's not forget. Maine's governor's race, for example, is one of the most closely watched contests at the state level this year. One political science professor said, in an election year, there are few things as popular as giving voters what voters see as free money from the state. Well, states are moving towards sending people money as consumer inflation is jumped roughly 8% over the past year. Some say it's even higher already in the double digits. Certainly on a wholesale basis, we see it is. Inflation boosted the typical family's food expenses by almost $600 last year. That's according to the Penn Wharton budget model. Overall, the average family had to spend $3,500 more last year to buy the same amount in goods and services as they purchased in years prior to the pandemic. Now, in New Mexico, some have questioned whether Democratic Governor Michelle Grisham's plan for a $250 rebate goes far enough, given the rise in consumer prices. The rebate plan in New Mexico and concerns about how much or how little it will help reflects a growing trend among states as they try to find some relief for their residents amid criticism that they could and ought to be doing more. Measures enacted since 2020 allotted a combined total of more than $500 billion to state and local governments. It's federal pandemic aid, that is. Some of that still sitting in state coffers waiting to be spent. I see a number of roads in my community that could use some of that money. From April 2021 to January 2022, total state revenues adjusted for inflation increased more than 19% compared to the same period a year earlier. It's according to the Urban Institute. And that's given state officials greater confidence to consider these tax rebates or direct payments to residents. But Lucy Dayan at the Urban Institute cautions state legislatures shouldn't rush into enacting permanent tax cuts based on what very well might be a temporary growth in real revenues. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Very interesting. There's new census data showing how profoundly the pandemic has reshaped the U.S. population. Americans fleeing cities for the sanctuary of cheaper or less populous areas. Just another study that shows similar results to what we've been talking about now for over a year. The Ozarks, Catskills, and Poconos were among the destinations with seasonal housing that saw significant year-round growth between mid-2020 and mid-2021. Counties on the outskirts of metro areas like Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis also saw bumps. The pricey megalopolises, I'll never get that right, New York, Newark, San Jose, San Francisco, Oakland, and L.A. Long Beach had stark net losses. Now, counterintuitively for a pandemic, nearly 3 out of 5 U.S. counties grew between July 20 and June 2021. That's largely due to people avoiding more crowded urban areas, instead heading for less crowded areas. More than 73% of U.S. counties experienced natural decrease in 2021, up significantly from the prior 2 years. And I hear some music. It means we're heading into another break. I hope you'll stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Well, not to be outdone by one of its neighbors to the north named Russia, North Korea test fired possibly its biggest intercontinental ballistic missile toward the sea today. That's according to its other neighbor to its immediate south, South Korea, that is, and it's raising the ante in a pressure campaign aimed at forcing the U.S. and other rivals to accept it as a nuclear power and remove crippling sanctions on it. The launch, which extended the North's barrage of missile tests this year, it seems, came after the U.S. and South Korean military said the country was preparing a flight of a new large ICBM first unveiled in October 2020. South Korea's military responded with the live fire drills of its own missiles launched from land, a fighter jet, and a ship, underscoring a revival of tensions as nuclear negotiations there remain frozen. South said it confirmed readiness to execute precision strikes against North Korea's missile launch points, as well as command and support facilities. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said that the North ICBM fired from the Sunan area near capital Pyongyang traveled 670 miles, reaching a maximum altitude of over 3,800 miles. Is that right? The missile was apparently fired on high angle to avoid reaching the territorial waters of Japan. Japan's Deputy Defense Minister Makoto Oniki said flight details suggesting a new type of ICBM were being analyzed. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said after arriving in Belgium for the Group of Seven meetings, it's an unforgivable recklessness. We resolutely condemn the act. Missile flew 71 minutes skyward and downward before possibly landing near Japanese territorial waters off the island of Hokkaido. Japan said it may search for debris inside its exclusive economic zone to analyze the North's technology. Japan's Coast Guard issued a warning to vessels in nearby waters, but there were no immediate reports of damage to boats or aircraft nearby. Japanese Fisheries Organization did release a statement denouncing the launch as a barbaric act that put fishermen's lives and livelihoods at risk. Talk about falling on deaf ears. South Korean President Moon Jae-in criticized Kim Jong-un for breaking a self-imposed moratorium on ICBM tests and posing a serious threat to the region and the broader international community. The U.S. condemned the North launch as well, with White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki calling it a brazen violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions that risks destabilizing the region's security. Psaki added that the United States will take all necessary measures to ensure the security of the American homeland and Republic of Korea and Japanese allies. In Brussels, Kishida and President Biden discussed the North's launch on the sidelines of the G7 summit, stressed the need for diplomacy with North Korea, and agreed to continue working together to hold Pyongyang responsible. Kim Dong-yub, a professor at Seoul's University of North Korean Studies, said flight details suggest the missile could reach targets over 9,300 miles away, when fired on normal trajectory with a warhead weighing less than a ton. That would place the entire U.S. mainland within striking distance, a sobering thought. North Korea's resumption of nuclear brinkmanship reflects a determination to cement its status as a nuclear power and rests badly needed economic concessions from Washington and others from a, well, what they think is a position of strength. Kim may also feel a need to trumpet his military accomplishments to his domestic audience as he grapples with a literal broken economy made worse by pandemic border closures. Another professor, Leif Erik Easley, said it would be a mistake for international policymakers to think the missile threat can be put on the back burner while the world deals with the pandemic and now Russia's invasion. In any event, it was North Korea's 12th round of weapon launches this year and came after it fired suspected artillery pieces into the sea on Sunday. Well, back to Russia, I guess you can call this a start. Kit Kat and Nesquik won't be sold in Russia, at least for now, any further, as parent company Nestle's tries to extract its business from the country, along with other consumer brands, including Pepsi, or PepsiCo, I guess, technically, and Procter & Gamble, the world's biggest food and beverage company, Nestle, is having to navigate decisions around providing essential food and supplies and pulling many others that could yield more profit. Ukraine's Vladimir Zelensky singled Nestle out last weekend for continuing to operate in Russia as hundreds of other corporations have left. Nestle had already been slowly shrinking its presence there since the war began, such as halting its advertising and shipments of other non-essential foods, including Nespresso coffee capsules and San Pellegrino. I guess that's the drinking water, sparkling water. The company also said it would donate any profits from Russia to humanitarian relief organizations. That's progress, but keep it going, Nestle. With the Prez, our Prez, arriving in Brussels today for three summits with NATO, the G7, and the EU, Vladimir Putin attempted to put on a show of normalcy for his citizens by reopening the Moscow Stock Exchange for some stock trading after a month's closure. Now, the exchange, which is known as MOEX, suspended all stock trading after the trading session on February 25th, the day after Putin's invasion. On the 24th of February, the day of Putin's invasion, the MOEX index plunged by as much as 45% before paring some of the losses to 33% by the close. After the MOEX shuttered trading, many Russian companies traded for pennies on the London Stock Exchange, as we had mentioned before. They also suspended trading in Russian companies. Pam and Russ Martins write in their latest Wall Street on Parade that the reopening of the MOEX today for stock trading was hardly an exercise in price discovery. The Russian government had previously announced on March 1st that its finance ministry would use up to $10.3 billion from its national wealth fund to prop up share prices of Russian companies by, yes, buying up shares. Now, it's highly likely that this figure is a vast understatement if the MOEX is to remain open, even for partial trading sessions each day. When the Martins say today's trading was stage managed, well, they're not being hyperbolic. The trading was shortened to just 4 hours, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Moscow time. Foreigners weren't even allowed to sell their shares. Only 33 companies were allowed to trade, or about 15% of all listed shares there. Short selling was also banned. It was evidenced by the trading today on the MOEX that the major beneficiaries of that $10.3 billion largesse from the National Wealth Fund were the largest state-owned energy companies in Russia. Rosneft closed up 17%, while Gazprom closed with a gain of over 13%. Other Russian shares, not so much love. Russia's largest bank, for example, the Sberbank, closed with a gain of just 4%. That's after losing almost, I think it was over 90% a couple weeks ago, while VTB Bank lost 5.5% by the close after being down double digits earlier. The Russian airline Aeroflot lost a whopping 16% after being down by as much as 20% in intraday trading. Foreign fund managers have little reason to want to do anything but sell their Russian stocks. The global index provider MSCI declared the market uninvestable after Putin's invasion of Ukraine and removed Russian stocks from its global indices. More than 400 corporations so far, including many of the famous brands, like one we mentioned, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, and so on, have announced that they're severing all business ties with Russia or closing their stores there and or suspending shipments of products. The fact that there was far more selling pressure occurring today than buying was evidenced by the fact that the MOEX index was initially up as much as 10% before fading into the close with a gain of just 4%. If that's all it can muster with government funds of $10.3 billion propping it up, it's going to be interesting to see what tomorrow brings. Markets in the best of times are more jittery on a Friday anyway, not knowing what major news might break over the weekend closure. But the U.S. suggesting Putin could roll out chemical or nuclear weapons in Ukraine at any time, it's going to be tough for the MOEX to sustain even a tepid rally for any significant amount of time. Well, even prior to Russia's invasion, the global food situation was highly stressed. Grain and meat prices up across the board. Fertilizer plants shutting down in Europe due to natural gas costs, just making production uneconomical. Now, of course, things are worse a month later. And Ukraine's a huge wheat supporter. Again, I think number 5 in the world. So is Russia, number 1. And Russia, ally Belarus, a key supplier of potash, a major fertilizer. In a recent conversation with Scott Irwin, he's an agriculture economist at the University of Illinois, Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal had these two takeaways. First, the high price of wheat and other grains will modestly lift food prices in rich countries such as the U.S., whereas in major importers like Egypt, the effects will be dramatic and potentially destabilizing. And second, things can get even worse from here. Rich countries may decide that they want to stockpile extra food right now, which maybe it makes sense on one level, but risk compounding the problem for poorer countries who can't afford to do that and can barely afford the food bill as it is. The impulse will, of course, be to hoard some products. But to prevent food prices from becoming more destabilizing, it may make sense to think about how aid and food can be distributed to poor food importers during this period of acute stress. Anyway, Wiesenthal says, Irwin offers tremendous insights into the global picture when new supply may be able to fill exports lost due to the war and what policy levers the Biden administration might be able to pull to ease the crisis. We'll keep you abreast of any new developments in this important area. And last today, one of the best-known recession indicators is flashing warning signs on the U.S. economy. Yields on longer-term U.S. government bonds are in danger of slipping below yields on short-term bonds, a relatively rare occurrence we call an inversion. Inverted yield curves can, well, reflect a rising risk of a coming economic recession. Analysts and investors closely watch for this early warning sign. Here's how it works. When the economy is healthy, yields, that's the interest rates investors are paid for buying government bonds, should be higher on the longer-term bonds. this year, short-term treasury yields, which, you know, tend to be driven by expectations for the Fed's monetary policy moves, have shot higher from about 0.75% to 2.2%. And that reflects the Fed's move to choke off inflation by raising its rates. Meanwhile, yields on longer-term treasuries, which tend to be more sensitive to the outlook for economic growth and inflation, have risen too, but a lot more slowly, from 1.5 to 2.4%. This reflects in part expectations that the war in Ukraine is going to hurt the world economies. The yield on the 10-year note is now only about a quarter percentage point higher than the 2-year note, with many analysts soon expecting the 10-year to fall below the 2-year. Pretty soon. That continues. The risk is for an inverted yield curve. Two-year to 10-year treasury inversions have preceded the last 8 recessions and 10 out of the last 13. But whether a recession follows could depend on whether the Fed continues to constrain the economy with rate hikes, if and when an inversion occurs. In any event, it's going to get ugly before it gets nicer out there. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow with Butch. Also, be on the lookout for a weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inbox in the morning. And on a personal note, a very happy birthday to my number one son, Lee. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Todd, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.